This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, violence focused national attention on an American tale of two cities. In western Michigan, on one side of the St. Joseph River, sits the aptly named town of St. Joseph. Its population is 90% white, the unemployment rate holds steady at about 2%, and the waterfront is lined with upscale restaurants and boutiques. On the other side of the river is Benton Harbor, a town of boarded-up buildings, potholed roads, where unemployment is at 25%. Benton Harbor's population is 92% African American. Last Monday, June 16th, an African American motorcyclist crashed in the course of a high-speed chase by police. His death triggered riots in Benton Harbor. The city has since quieted down, but the future remains uncertain. Sadly, what happened in Benton Harbor is not a new phenomenon. Riots, particularly racially charged riots, have plagued American cities since the Revolution. Parts of Chicago, Tulsa, Detroit, New York, Los Angeles have all gone up in flames, and that's just a few. Is there a roadmap to recovery? Can the recommendations of blue ribbon commissions and the plans of visionary architects lead a ravaged city to recovery? If you live somewhere that was overcome with rioting, give us a call. Has your city recovered? Can these cities recover? What does recovery require? Call us with your post-riot memories and recommendations. Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. And joining us now from her office in Benton Harbor, Michigan, is the Reverend Mattie Roddy. She's the former president of the Twin City Area Branch of the NAACP and is current pastor of the Church of Our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in Benton Harbor. And Reverend Roddy, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
You've been a community leader and an activist for over 30 years. Were you surprised by this rioting last week?
No, we were not.
Why not?
Well, we had had a lot of indication over the years that there was a lot of complaints against both our law enforcement and the criminal justice system. And we had went to those individuals to try to talk to them, and it was to no avail.
And there are underlying conditions which a lot of people are resentful of. Is that fair to say in Benton Harbor?
Well, the conditions of joblessness and poverty and made to be felt that you're left out of the system creates a hostile, intense environment in our community. Benton Harbor is a city that is 64% female heads of household. 90% of those are receiving welfare or some sort of assistance.
And I'm just asking if this is made worse by the fact that Benton Harbor is ringed by much more prosperous communities.
Of course. Benton Harbor is completely surrounded by Benton Township, which is the largest township in Michigan. And it's very more well-established homes and well-established community people. Even the middle-class blacks tend to live in Benton Township and surrounded by St. Joe, Michigan, which is very affluent compared to the Benton Harbor community. It has been estimated that the average wage in St. Joe, Michigan is about $30,000, and the average wage in Benton Harbor is less than $10,000.
None of that is to say, though, that conditions like that justify riots.
Certainly do not. And I've been on the street for the last 3 days talking with the citizens and talking with the children to let them know that that's not an acceptable form of protest.
Now, we understand you were part of a conference with the governor, Governor Grantham, recently in Benton Harbor about establishing an official commission. How did that go, do you think?
Well, the governor did meet with community leaders to talk about, pledge her allegiance to trying to help the situation here in Benton Harbor, Michigan. She did talk about setting up a small committee to examine the conditions that created the problem. We are concerned about who that commission might be.
And that's unclear as to who would be on it as yet?
what we have seen so far is a group of individuals that are outside of the community gaining the ear of the governor here in Michigan, and we are very concerned about that.
Okay. What do you think that Benton Harbor needs in order to rebuild?
Well, I think, first of all, the community itself has to realize that the elected officials, or the officials they elected, have to take responsibility for making sure that their needs are heard and adhered to. I would have suggested to the commission, and we did suggest to the commission, that they began to, number one, determine a blueprint for the Benton Harbor community. For after all, the citizens do look to their elected officials to make decisions on their behalf. And we want to make sure that the Benton Harbor Commission understands that it is their full responsibility to make sure that their citizens are protected in their communities. And they are giving a lot of tax breaks to industries that are coming into the community that are not hiring the Benton Harbor citizens who are qualified for those positions.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, and let's go on the line now with Jack, who's with us from Niles, Michigan.
How you doing, Neil?
Okay.
I was thinking about last week. I heard on the radio that while Governor Granholm was visiting Benton Harbor at the same time, they're announcing a Michigan bid to site the next generation Boeing aircraft plant. They put in a proposal to site the next generation Boeing aircraft up on the Detroit area. I just thought it would be kind of a nice juxtaposition if maybe they put in a proposal to site it over in the Benton Harbor area, which is directly across from Chicago, which is the new Boeing headquarters for national headquarters.
I did see that story, Jack. I think they actually proposed three different areas in Michigan as possible sites. But one of them is quite near Detroit. And Matty Roddy, is there any discussion of this in Benton Harbor?
No, there's not.
I think, Jack, one of the things that you need to have before you put an airplane plant there is a big airfield, and I'm not sure there is one in Benton Harbor.
Actually, there's a fairly good-sized airfield there that they've run for a number of years that Northwestern Airlines was flying fairly large jets in and out. But you're right, they need I forget what it is, 10,000-foot runway or fairly significant runway. But that's something I think the area around Benton Harbor is rural enough to support the development of that field.
Well, Jack, thanks for the suggestion. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Matty Roddy, before we let you go, I want to ask you, how do you think that the riots have they hurt your city? In what way?
Well, certainly it brought negative national attention once again to Benton Harbor. But I think that what we have to understand that it will probably continue to receive negative attention until the community and those that say that they're the leaders of the community begin to communicate with each other. First of all, you have to have respect for each other and each other's abilities before you can begin to sit down and make a plan for your citizens. You have to look in-house first, and in the house, there is some problems, and among the leaders and as the clergy as well as elected officials. And those individuals, or we individuals, have to begin to sit down to make some sense and develop some respect and communication with each other. We cannot help our citizens if we're fighting each other. And part of the problem in Benton Harbor lies with the ins and the outs, and there the nonsense has to stop. It has to be someone has to mature enough to say, okay, what is the bottom line? Because this is hurting all of us. It is. We're going to pay one way or another. We're going to either pay with the law enforcement end of it, or we're going to pay with the knowledge that we have a permanent subclass in our community which have been neglected and is now saying, you will never neglect us again. We will see to that.
Is that what you mean? They're the outs?
They're the outs.
And who are the ins?
Well, the ins is those who play to the powers in the interest groups. And who are they? And what the community has begun to do is look at who's speaking for Benton Harbor. Are the Benton Harbor elected officials speaking for Benton Harbor, or are they listening to beat of other drums? And we have to challenge that. We have to do it in a way that we can all come together, but we have to challenge that.
Maddie Roddy, first, on behalf of everybody, we're so sorry that this happened, and we hope the best for the town to recover.
Thank you so much.
Maddie Roddy is former president of the Twin City Area Branch of the NAACP. She's current pastor of the Church of Our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and she spoke with us from her office there. If you'd like to join our conversation, by the way, our number in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from the studios of member station WBEZ in Chicago is Alex Kotlowitz, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thanks for having me, Neil.
Alex Kotlowitz's book, The Other Side of the River, examined the relationship between Benton Harbor and its neighbor, St. Joseph. Much has been made of the differences in these two towns since unrest began in Benton Harbor. St. Joseph, largely white and affluent compared with Benton Harbor, mostly African-American. And let me ask you the same question that I began with Maddie Roddy. Are you surprised by this incident?
Yeah, I was surprised and shaken by what happened last week. I mean, who couldn't be by the destruction that went on in the town? But having said that, what I wasn't surprised at was the depth of the anger that many folks in Benton Harbor have, particularly towards the criminal justice system from the courts on down. There's a long history there, and memories linger.
As we mentioned, your book is about different perceptions between people in Benton Harbor and people in St. Joseph's. And tell us a little bit about the book. It revolves around one particular case, a drowning.
Right. First of all, I should tell you, I was drawn to these two towns in large part because not because they were somehow anomalous, because I think they're pretty typical of how most of us live, so close and yet so disconnected. The divide here is quite dramatic. As you pointed out earlier, it's a river. And the story that drew me up there was a story of a 16-year-old African-American youth, Eric McGinnis, who on a Friday night in summer of 1991 was at a teenage nightclub hanging out with some white friends and apparently broke into a car and was rummaging through the glove compartment when the owner of the car, a middle-aged white gentleman, caught him. And a chase ensued away from the river, and Eric disappeared. And 5 days later, his body was found in the river that separates these two towns. And what so intrigued me about his death was how these two communities, one white and the other black, came to the death of this one boy from such extraordinarily different perspectives. Virtually everybody in St. Joseph was convinced that Eric died accidentally, that he, knowing the police were out looking for him, had tried to swim the river to get home. And virtually everybody in Benton Harbor was convinced that Eric died as a result of foul play, most likely at the hands of whites, because he had been dating a white girl. And so you had this kind of very peculiar American Rashomon that revolved around people's personal and collective experiences that had everything to do with race.
And obviously an issue that has not gotten away. There were two nights of riots in Benton Harbor, Michigan last week. When we come back from a break, we're going to be taking your calls with Alex Kotlowitz and discussing whether the lessons learned by other cities in the aftermath of their racially inspired riots, whether those lessons can help in Benton Harbor, and indeed whether those other cities have been able to recover with all the recommendations of the Blue Ribbon Commissions and the anxieties of experts who've come in to examine their situations. Our phone number, if you'd like to help us with this examination, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Alex Kotlowitz is our guest. He's with us from the studios of member station WBEZ in Chicago. We're discussing how cities recover after riots, or indeed if they do. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Alex Kotlowitz, before we get onto the phone calls, I just wanted to follow up on your conversation about Benton Harbor and St. Joseph just before the break. This incident that different people interpreted very differently, it illustrated the racial problems there, but it did not trigger the same kind of violence we saw this last week.
Right, it didn't, though there were some incidents after Eric's body was found. But you're right, it didn't. And it's hard to know sort of what that stress point is. But there's no question, I mean, as Reverend Roddy suggested, this is a community under great duress. And I suspect if it hadn't been this incident last Sunday, it appears that it might well have just been another incident that happened down the road. But very little, in fact, has changed in the community over the past 15, 20 years.
Let's get listeners involved. Mike joins us now on the line from San Diego in California.
Hi, I wanted to offer a couple perspectives from the viewpoint of someone who grew up in Gary, Indiana in the 60s and 70s. And I'm sure Mr. Koppelwitz has passed through Gary on his trips to and from Benton Harbor. It's about 60, 70 minutes southwest of Benton Harbor. Gary underwent limited actual overt rioting in the late 60s. However, it, like Detroit, suffered greatly from what is called quiet riot. And by what I mean there is ongoing acts of vandalism, looting that slowly and steadily chip away at civilization in the cities. Detroit and Gary are two prime examples, resulting in a situation where merchants flee. What used to be called white flight has turned into everyone concerned about their safety flight, regardless of race. Businesses only being able to function through revolving barred doors. It's embarrassing to conduct yourself or live in a situation like that. Limited choices. Delivery people will not deliver to Gary. Service calls will not be made there. To me, it's a failure of law enforcement from two perspectives. First, law enforcement comes under criticisms by people who perhaps rightly sometimes, certainly more earlier and certainly more in the South than in current days up north, felt that blacks were being targeted. But uniform, strict enforcement of laws across the board, from the corporate level on down to the pettiest of thefts or car break-ins, such as involved Mr. Eric in Benton Harbor, is, from my perspective, a big part of the solution in this. And I want you to understand that I am a lawyer. I come from a prosecutorial perspective, so bear that in mind when you judge my comments. But I think that even-handed, strict law enforcement, not demagoguery by outsiders coming in, some of which the Reverend referred to. She didn't name names, but I can't help but think that Reverend Jesse Jackson was involved because he did come to Benton Harbor. That's not the solution. Okay?
Well, if I might, Neil, if I might just respond. I mean, you know, a couple things come to mind when you mention Gary. I mean, one, you're right that I think people in Benton Harbor would argue that what's needed, as you said, is even-handed law enforcement. And I think there's a
law enforcement.
And I think there's a feeling among many in Benton Harbor that law enforcement, in fact, hasn't been even-handed. But when you mention Gary, for me, the thing that I think about most that that is similar to Benton Harbor is these are both communities in which work has virtually disappeared. I mean, Gary, which was built around the steel mills, Benton Harbor, which was built around these manufacturing plants and foundries. And I would argue that, you know, work is the very thread that holds the social fabric together. And when it's gone, that social fabric begins to unravel. I mean, as Neil, as you pointed out earlier in the show, that the unemployment rate at Benton Harbor now is 25%. I mean, an astonishingly high number.
True enough, but to a point. Victor Hugo does not set social policy. The mere lack of opportunity does not create a right to thieve for it. And the Reverend recognized that. I was glad to hear her recognize that. So let's get off that disconnect. Read excuse for crime. You don't have to have that. That, to me, is what distinguishes a responsible citizen from an irresponsible citizen. Now, the only thing we know about Eric's death is that we know for sure he was caught breaking into someone's car, and he was found dead 5 days later. Everything else on either side of the river, on either side of the issue, is pure speculation. Can we agree on that?
Right. I mean,
That sort of speculation inflames tempers.
And part of my book is about just that, is about the myths that we build up about each other, and in fact, the myths that we built up about ourselves.
Yes, and
well,
by the way, I was asked earlier whether I do go back to Gary. Yes, I go back twice a year because that's where my home was. You know, I've got good memories of it. But those memories were from an active community, not the sort of foisted community that's offered up today as, you know, outreach and wonderful healing experiences and all this garbage. I'm talking little leagues, church socials, community clubs, stuff that arose spontaneously from people just getting together. And I'm talking black, white, whatever. The nice thing about growing up in Gary, from my perspective, I saw diversity firsthand, and real diversity without being forced as it is today. Diversity among whites, among Hispanics, among blacks, everyone. And we all got along. And there was unemployment back then, too.
Mike, we want to get back to the Benton Harbor and post-riot construction, but thanks very much for your call. We appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for taking it.
One of the things that Mike was talking about was the police force that was certainly at the center of events in Cincinnati in 2001 after policemen shot and killed Timothy Thomas, an unarmed 19-year-old black youth. Rioting erupted there. And joining us now on the line from his office in Cincinnati is Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Kevin Aldridge. And good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
You covered those riots, and again, this goes back. Was anybody surprised when they erupted?
Well, I think there was some surprise, but I think as we look back on it, even hear from the newspaper and a lot of folks in the community, I think all the signs pointed to the fact that there was some definite increasing tensions and a build up to it. I think there wasn't a surprise that there was that kind of anger present in the community, but the fact that it would manifest itself in the way that it did, I think, was the surprising part. But I don't think anyone was blind to the fact that Cincinnati has some serious issues when it came to race relations.
And what has it done since the riots in an attempt to recover?
Well, there have been a number of things underway. You know, Cincinnati has, we've come a long way from April, but we've still got much farther to go as a city in terms of getting to where we need to be. Shortly after the riots in April of 2001, the mayor formed a commission called Cincinnati Community Action Now that was basically designed to take a look at the disparities that existed racially in the areas of economics, education, government, and try to find out how to break down some of those barriers so that everyone could be on a level playing field. And the commission kind of got off to a slow start. It took them several months. It was comprised of hundreds of volunteers from a cross-section of the community, from business to just very grassroots people. And it took them a while to get off the ground, and I think people were kind of impatient with the commission at first because it took them so long to get organized and really get off the ground. But probably about 2 weeks ago, they unveiled a list of about a dozen programs and initiatives that really have an opportunity to make a real difference for folks here in Cincinnati down the road if they receive the type of funding that that they need. And I think we'll see some changes coming out of there.
If they receive the funding, that's a kind of a big if, yeah.
Right.
In the meantime, there are a lot of African Americans in Cincinnati who still feel that their voices are not being listened to. They've organized a boycott.
Yeah, exactly. There are about three to four grassroots civil rights groups here in Cincinnati that in July of 2001, after the riots, again, these were some of the folks who were kind of dismayed that changes weren't coming as fast as they thought they should have after the riots, and they kind of got together and organized a boycott of the city, where they were asking conventions not to come here, tourists, entertainers not to come to Cincinnati to spend money, specifically in the downtown portion of Cincinnati. And at first, the boycott kind of got off to a slow start. It was really organized not necessarily by any of the major movers and shakers in town, but these were really just kind of street level folks, and it got off kind of slow. But then I'd say around February of 2002 was when it really took off, when comedian Bill Cosby actually canceled two performances here in Cincinnati in honor of the boycott, saying that he didn't feel comfortable performing his comedy in Cincinnati in such a racially charged environment. And then kind of after that, you started to see more and more high-profile entertainers follow suit. Two of the largest conventions that we had booked here, one in 2002 and another this year, both canceled as a result of the boycott. So there kind of been mixed reviews on the level of success on it, depending on who you might ask around town as to how much support it actually has or how effective that it's actually been. But it has received some national attention. Al Sharpton's been to town to say that he supports those who are calling for the boycott and the boycott. Martin Luther King III has also expressed his concern and his support for the boycott. In fact, we had an annual dinner that's held downtown every year on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, and Martin Luther King III actually had the organizers of that event take his father's name off of the event because he didn't want it associated with it until the city began to address more seriously some of the racial issues here.
Let's get another listener involved, and Lynette joins us now on the line from Los Angeles.
Yes, good afternoon. I just, you know, I'm looking at all of this pattern of the riots and everything, and it just reminds me of how we're just turning back the clocks on our civil rights and, of course, you know, our civil liberties. And I believe that we're just going to have to take another step, not only with the boycotting and holding the elected officials accountable, but just outright, you know, suing these police commissions and police unions that retain a lot of these violent, brutal cops who perpetrate upon the citizenry that actually pay the taxes and make the way for America, rather than prosecuting them and trying them on the streets.
Well,
and really, that's the heart of it. I mean, I am for the boycotting and the picketing, but we've been down that road. This is time to go ahead and do this pretty much like what New York had done, you know, with the Abner Louima case. They sued everybody. They cleaned house. They started over. And then we need to have an economic empowerment zone for all of these cities that are in crisis with these issues, you know.
Well, why do we...
Be it from Appalachia to the inner city, wherever these problems are, because we know that poverty it will breed violence and disease, and we cannot afford that.
Well, let's get back to the police force part of Lynette's question. And Kevin Aldridge, this police force was certainly at the heart of this rioting that erupted.
Yeah, they were, and there have actually been some changes with regard to that here in Cincinnati as well. And we have entered into kind of what is called here the collaborative agreement, which was basically an agreement between the Department of Justice, United States Department of Justice, the City of Cincinnati, and some of the African American groups here in Cincinnati. Basically a group that represents just about every African-American in Cincinnati. They entered into agreement about a year ago that provides for sweeping changes in the way that Cincinnati police officers do their jobs, from everything from the training, the technology that they use to track police stops and things of that nature, to even how the police dogs here are dispatched. So there have been some really significant changes with regard to the police department. Now, that transition hasn't been easy. There's been some, you know, snags in the road here and there, and the sides, anytime you enter into an agreement like this, you know, all sides are going to be jockeying to try and make sure that they get the best deal possible for those that they represent. So, you know, there have been those issues, but I think you're really starting to see here at least the parties coming to a consensus on how policing can be better here in Cincinnati.
Kevin Aldridge, thanks very much for being with us today.
No problem.
Kevin Aldridge, a reporter with the Cincinnati Enquirer, and he was with us from his office in Cincinnati. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Alex Kotlowitz, the author of The Other Side of the River, is still with us from the studios of member station WBEZ in Chicago. And we're going back to the phones. Diane joins us now from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Hello.
Hi.
I grew up in Benton Harbor, actually, on the between Bishop and Jennings on Empire. And I believe I've met Alex. I was a student at one of the schools, and he took us on a bus ride tour trying to explain what it was he was writing his book about. My comment regarding the riots when I initially heard about them was just that it was nothing new. This was probably the first time, though, of this magnitude that they couldn't claim race against the police department because they believed the officers were all African American. I remember growing up other incidents, and certainly throwing Molotov cocktails at homes was not rare by any stretch of the imagination. I guess my question is, maybe I'm cynical, but I really don't see any hope for Benton Harbor. I never have. Part of it might be because growing up, my family often commented that the best thing that could happen was for the whole city to be razed and kind of start again fresh. Does Alex have hope?
Alex, do you have hope?
I guess I always have hope. I guess that's why I keep on writing. I guess writing is in itself a sign of hope. I mean, I guess for me, the thing that's hopeful about it are the people that at least I met in Benton Harbor, people like Reverend Roddy and others, who I think would love to see not only the community revived, but also see some connection to the communities around them. And, you know, I think part of it is bringing work back. I think part of it is listening, telling stories, finding a way to sort of understand each other's history and to make sense of it. I think part of it is as is in Cincinnati, is resources. You look, for example, at the schools in Benton Harbor. I mean, some of the elementary schools, I was told earlier today by somebody up there that the roofs are leaking. So, and I also think that it's also a question, as the first listener pointed out, that there's both this kind of collective responsibility that we have towards communities like Benton Harbor, and then there's also the kind of personal responsibility, because I think it's important to also point out that Benton Harbor in the past 10 or 15 years has been racked by a flourishing underground economy and the drug trade. The violence at times has been almost out of control. In fact, back in the early 90s, it had the highest per capita murder rate in the country.
That's when we lived downtown.
Right. So it's a community that suffers both, you know, in because of people's choices, but also very much because of the constant duress that people are under.
Well, my folks lived there for 20 years, or actually, no, they lived there for 30 years. And my father kept holding out hope, which is one reason why, I mean, we were, we used to say the last of the white Mohicans. We were the last white people for about nine blocks, square blocks, for a long time. And he just was saddened. And while we had a really wonderful relationship with all of our immediate neighbors and pretty much the neighborhood at large, there was still so much violence. And there were drug houses in, you know, the block that our home existed in. And, I mean, I remember seeing a riot when I was in fourth grade that the man picked up our metal trash can and actually beat somebody else to death. And I was sitting on the front porch. So the thought of the violence just really, I don't know, I guess I'm still amazed that it's made national news. And I guess it does give me a little hope that if it did make national news, maybe something will be done. Maybe some more resources will be directed towards Benton Harbor. I don't know.
Diane, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
We're talking about how cities recover from riots after a break. What lessons can we learn from America's deadliest race riots? I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Alex Kotlowitz, the author of The Other Side of the River, is with us from the studios of member station WBEZ in Chicago. We're discussing how towns and cities like Benton Harbor, Michigan, can recover from riots and civil unrest. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you lived through rioting, and has your city recovered? Our phone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his office in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, is University of Alabama Law Professor Al Brophy. Professor Brophy is the author of Reconstructing the Dreamland, the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. Recently, he was legal consultant to the Tulsa Race Riot Commission, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good to be with you.
Every city and every riot is unique. In Tulsa, as you recount in your book, police arrested a young black man for allegedly assaulting a white woman. A lynching was planned. Blacks marched on the police department in protest. And then there was a little short of an attack on the black section of town. Police deputized and armed a mob of white people who burned down the black section of town called Greenwood. The Dreamland was a theater in the center of Greenwood. That's thus the title of your book. And I wonder, did Greenwood ever recover?
Greenwood, an interesting part of the story of Tulsa is that though the immediate trajectory was the pretty much complete destruction of the African-American section of Tulsa, about 8,000 people were left homeless, is that in the decade following the riot, largely through their own efforts, Greenwood residents were able to rebuild, so that by the middle of the 1930s, you had a community that was had nicer homes, was wealthier than it had been before the riot.
And what does it look like today?
The tragedy, of course, of Tulsa is that Greenwood today is largely a section of empty lots. If you went through exactly at the where the Dreamland Theater once stood in Tulsa right now, is an interstate. And so the problems of the Tulsa community and the African-American community in the aftermath of the riot were largely the same as African-American communities throughout the country, right? There was a resilience in the years leading up to World War II, and then, you know, the tragedy of great American cities after the war has been legacies of neglect and poverty.
You were a consultant to the Tulsa Race Riot Commission. Now, what is that?
That was a commission established in the mid-1990s to investigate the riot. It was something that people within the Greenwood community in the African-American section of Tulsa were well familiar with, but virtually nobody outside of that community had ever heard of it. And so the Oklahoma legislature investigated the riot with the idea that they wanted to recover something of that history, get the story better known, and also think about what they could do to move forward from this sort of shared legacy of violence, right, in which the white community, largely through the actions of the police department and the local units of the National Guard, had essentially wiped out the black community. And what they ultimately recommended was that there be some reparations paid to riot survivors. That never happened, and so last February, Professor Charles Ogletree of Harvard Law School filed a lawsuit on behalf of riot victims.
Mm-hmm. Now, this almost approaches the idea of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, the kind of thing we saw in South Africa after the end of apartheid. And in Tulsa, obviously, you had a very serious situation, and this was the deadliest riot in American history, the deadliest race riot in any extent. And I wonder if we bring Alex Kotlowitz into the situation. Obviously, it's one thing to do this, roughly 80 years after the event, whether things like that can apply to situations as we saw in Benton Harbor.
Well, I think absolutely. I think that the extraordinary thing about what happened in Tulsa was this acknowledgement of the place of history in the present. And I think one of the things in talking about a place like Benton Harbor is we're so quick to neglect its history because its history mirrors what happened to many African-American communities in the North. You know, blacks were in the 30s and 40s were recruited there by white industrialists to work in the factories and foundries. They came up there, many of them in trucks and good-paying jobs. Their families followed. And then two things happened, which happened everywhere else. In the 60s, as that balance began to shift, there was all this white flight, except here all the whites fled, or many of them fled to the other side of the river to St. Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
The newspaper followed, the hospital, the FBI offices, the post office. And then during the Deep Recession of the late 70s and 80s, those factories and foundries shut down and work disappeared. And in addition to that, there are lingering memories of incidents in the past that for many have never been resolved. One of them that I always think back on that happened in the early 70s was a man by the name of Floyd Caldwell who had robbed a judge and his wife at knife point in front of their garage and was sentenced to two consecutive terms of natural life. And I do think that it's that history, I think, that's so important, that bears so much on the present.
Right, and I think it's a way in which we need to grapple with the shared history, right? Right after the Tulsa riot, the white prosecutor in Tulsa convened a grand jury, and that grand jury essentially exonerated the whites and the police department and laid blame for the rioting on the African-American community, which was part of then making the African-American community bear the costs of rebuilding, right? So you've got these two memories now. In the white community, folks have sort of forgotten about the riot, and in the black community, folks are left to sort of, to their own devices to remember the riot and the hurt. And I think the Riot Commission is attempted to try and put these sort of two pieces of the puzzle together. That's really difficult to do, though.
Well, let's get listeners back involved. And joining us now from his car in Wichita, Kansas, is Randy. And welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
First, I want to just let the people of Benton Harbor know that my heart goes out to you because it seems that this is totally uncalled for to have a man killed because of a high-speed chase. And then the rioting is probably a normal reaction. We had a riot in Wichita in 1980 among mixed crowds on Easter Sunday, where the police overreacted to a parking situation and lobbed tear gas into the crowd. Since that time, the police have made a conscientious effort to put substations into the neighborhoods to be more community responsive and community involved. And I think it's time for the people across the river from Benton Harbor to get involved in finding the solution to this.
From what you're saying, Randy, this doesn't sound like a racial incident.
No, it wasn't a racial incident. The riot happened amongst mixed crowds, but what I'm saying is it was an overreaction of the police force that created the riot to begin with, and I think this is the same situation that happened with the Rodney King affair and this incident in Benton Harbor. If we look back, riots are a reaction to police overzealously enforcing or exercising their power, and I think that it's really a charge on the police force to say, what did we do wrong and how can we correct this situation?
Well, again, I'm not sure that any situation justifies rioting, that burning down people's houses and that sort of thing. Fortunately, there's been no loss of life in the current situation in Benton Harbor, but certainly bricks and stones were thrown, and that's distressing in any event. But, Randy, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Al Brophy, is certainly Tulsa involved a police department run amok? Is the situation, is it possible to take race out of the situation as we seem to be described in the last phone call?
One of the interesting things I think about when you think about riots, at least in recent American history, you think about sort of Watts, L.A. in 92, right, in which the African-American community is sort of major participants in the riot. That's an aberration in American history. It's really up until World War II. Whenever there were riots, that was the white community going in and burning out the black community. And I think what's important in thinking about cases like Tulsa is that it was largely the police department and their special deputies who went in and arrested, disarmed everybody, brought them to what newspapers called concentration camps, and then looted and burned down that section of town. And I think it's this sort of legacy of government-sponsored violence that one has to deal with, right? Ralph Ellison, author of Invisible Man, talks about this. He says there are two histories. The winners decamp the field, and the losers are left to pick up the pieces for themselves. And I think that's a lot of what we need to work with. And I think in Benton Harbor also.
Right. I think you're generally right, but obviously the race riots, the draft riots in New York City during the Civil War were in part, there was a racial element to that, but that wasn't the main focus of that, and obviously they were extremely deadly too. So
yeah, the New York draft riots are, I mean, it's a race and class thing.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another listener involved. Tom joins us on the line from Tallahassee.
Yeah, I sure am, and I couldn't disagree more with your guest's comments just now or the caller from before. The whole underlying premise of the show seems to be that, you know, somehow, what can the white community do to stop this from happening again? What did we do to bring this on? And that's a little bit like saying, well, she got raped. You know, what'd she do to get raped? Was she wearing suggestive clothing? Was she walking around at night?
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective you have. In fact, the young man who was in jail on charges of attempted assault, it turns out, and it is another tragedy of the Tulsa riot, is that there wasn't anything to the charges.
You know, I don't really care about what happened in the 1930s. I'm talking about the here and now. The victims of the past are terrible and it's a tragedy, but I'm concerned about the people who are alive, that we can stop this from happening again.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, we got to put responsibility where it lies. Now, when a motorcyclist is fleeing the police, who are black from what I understand, and has an accident, I have a real hard time saying, well, that's a racial incident. And I remind them that this whole thing could have been prevented if the motorcyclist had just pulled over. What are we supposed to do? Say that if you're in some sort of criminal activity and you speed up, the cops are supposed to just pull over on the side of the road and let you escape?
Well, Tom, I think one of the things that people are saying is if it hadn't been this spark, it would have been another, that the underlying conditions were like a tinderbox, and that This was a place so resentful that it was ready to go up. Not that that justifies rioting. I'm not saying that it does.
And I think that there's something that we could do about that. It's a very simple solution. If the media were to be more even-handed on their reporting, have you noticed that in the last 20 or 30 years, whenever the perpetrator of the crime is black and the victim is white, they don't mention the race? But if the reverse is true, not only do they say the perpetrator was white and the victim was black, but they insinuate that it was some sort of racially motivated crime. They just did it a couple of days ago on, you know, whenever it's a racial issue where the victims are black, it's a major headline. And what that does is, for the casual listener, it gives a clear impression that there's a major conspiracy to oppress black people in this country. Well, we're probably one of the few countries that have, you know, aggressive affirmative action and all sorts of court remedies.
Well, so, you know, it's really interesting that you, you know, suggest that you don't care what happened back in the 1920s during the riot. You know, there's 120 people who are still alive whose houses were burned, who never received any compensation for that. And you know, I mean, for you, I understand that's a long time ago. This is you know, an event within the lifetimes of lots of people.
Well, we'd like to thank Tom for his call, and let's see if we can get one final caller in. Mac joins us now from Oklahoma City in Oklahoma.
Yes, I understand that there'll be racial problems everywhere in the whole world, just as well as it is here. But I think there needs to be blame accepted on the black community. I'm a black man myself. And I think the main problem is that majority of the educated and wealthy blacks are in the white communities. When integration occurred, most of the black people decided to go to the white neighborhoods, and the black people that were left were the uneducated, drug addicts, alcoholics, and so forth. And that's why just about everywhere you look in America, the black communities, they are depressed, they are poor, and they're uneducated. And that's why we have crime, black crime on black crime.
Alex Kotlowitz, Matty Roddy, we just have a few seconds left, but I wanted you to address this. At the beginning of the program, Matty Roddy certainly suggested that the leadership of Benton Harbor has a lot to answer for.
I don't think there's any question about it that it's a call for leadership both within the black and the white community to find a way to sort of make these issues a part of the public discourse again. But I just want to underscore something that I think Al Brophy has talked about so eloquently. And undoubtedly, there will be a commission formed in Michigan, if not in Benton Harbor, to examine the roots of these disturbances last week. And I guess in doing so, I hope obviously that there is some notion about how to move ahead, but I hope there's also some sense and some ability to look at the past and to look at the history and to sort of understand again the place of history in the present and what it does to help people perceive their place in the world.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Mac, thank you very much for the phone call.
You're welcome.
And our thanks to our guests, Al Brophy, professor of law at the University of Alabama Law School, the author of Reconstructing the Dreamland. He was with us from his office in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
And Alex Kotlowitz was with us most of this hour. He's the author of The Other Side of the River. He was with us from the studios of member station WBEZ in Chicago. And Alex, thanks very much for taking the time out to join us today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.